He's good. Bigfoot's good. We're good. And so we're going to do this. That's actually his name, Bigfoot.
He doesn't
exist. People don't think he exists, but you've met him.
Yeah.
Someday we'll get him more on camera. I think people have seen his hand, like the actual Bigfoot. So I'm here with FDA's Chief AI Officer, Jeremy Walsh. We had a big announcement today, and we're thrilled to have with us two doctors that we love, Dr. Emma Marr from the University of Pennsylvania. She's professor of medicine and pharmacology and also the vice dean for clinical research and translational research. And Dr. Jennifer Litton, chief clinical research officer at MD Anderson Cancer Center. If you have not heard of the University of Pennsylvania or MD Anderson Cancer Center, let me tell you a little bit about them. They are small, up-and-coming institutions in the healthcare system. So great to have you here, and thanks for joining us. Exciting day.
Yeah, very exciting day.
It was a great day. I mean, I can't thank you both enough for taking the time to come to the FDA. Listening to both of your sort of stories was just had left such an impression on me in terms of the work that you do every day. You know, taking care of patients, trying to drive, you know, both on the drug development side, on the sort of the cancer delivery side, cancer sort of patient side. So I think I was, it was really just a profound experience to sort of listen to that.
Why don't you say, we just came from the announcement, so maybe you can share a little bit about what it was.
What's been happening is that over time, the FDA receives more and more information, right? You've got your phase one trials, your phase two trials, your phase three trials. And so as part of that process, you enroll as a patient, you go into a site, your data is being collected, it's being, as you mentioned, sort of being transformed into multiple different systems, which is then sort of cleaned, right? You know, looked at, analyzed, cleaned, locked, and then eventually sort of sent to the FDA, right? This takes time, right? And it's costly, and it's time-consuming, and also actually kind of a little bit prone to error in some scenarios as well, right? So there's a lot of stuff that happens within that process, and so what the FDA is sitting here is saying, how can we reimagine that? You know, and really it comes down to the sort of the thought process is, what data do we need to make a decision? What information does the FDA truly need in order to make a regulatory decision, especially in your early phase one and phase two trials, right? Like where we mostly focus around the safety side. So I think today was an announcement around that, you know, we have launched real-time clinical trials. We are looking at we're starting from a standpoint of the least amount of information as possible, signal data, right? Any type of signal the FDA defines as part of this trial, industry will be analyzing, and then they'll be sending to that us in real time, and then our reviewers are going to be looking at that. And so that's the beauty of what we're doing. We're almost kind of resetting the clock a little bit, restarting the conversation around. We know you can send us everything. Let's start with what we need. So I think that's kind of was the announcement today.
Great. So today the FDA announced the first ever real-time clinical trial. This is not a theoretical. It's not an idea. It's not a panel to discuss the future possibility. It's not an expression of intent. It is live. It is up and running. Your centers are participating. And so it's exciting. Tell us a little bit about it, if you could start, Emma.
Just really excited about the idea that the FDA is focusing on process innovation. I mean, it's long overdue for all of us to actually focus on that. On a very practical level in the trenches, you know this, the amount of time that you spend entering information into systems, and there's no shortage of them, is lost time.
It's mind-numbing.
Mind-numbing. And it's actually mind-numbing for the people who do it.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that it's really hard to keep them in their jobs. You know, they're not terribly well-paying jobs to begin with, and it's boring, repetitive work, and it is prone to error, no question. And then it gets analyzed by the docs who are in the fields doing the trials, and then it gets transmitted to the company who then analyze the information, and it's kind of redundancy and repetitiveness that isn't necessary. So this concept has the real potential of being transformative. I think that if we do this truly as a partnership, and I said this earlier today, 20 years ago, the FDA was a regulatory body. Today, the FDA has a position that it wants to partner on solutions. And that in and of itself is transformative. So for academia to partner with industry and the FDA in an innovative approach to actually accelerate this incredibly painful process, it can be a game changer. Really can. We need to do it right. We need to do it in a sustained fashion, but it can be a game changer.
You know, I started off my career in the 90s as a study coordinator doing breast cancer trials, which is how I became a breast cancer doctor. And it is really not different than 1996.
Hasn't changed.
I would sit there. I got a laptop. Now, the laptop was this big, and you would open it, and you would take it from the paper records. You would put it into this, and then it went to three other places. And you were collecting so much data that, because there was this fear of, if I don't get the right piece of data, I'm not going to get the answer I need at the end. So let's collect every time this person sneezes, let's, how many times a day do they sneeze? And I'm not trying to make a joke about, because safety and rigorous clinical research is important, but that's the whole point of today. You're saying we're absolutely going to do rigorous clinical trials. We are going to see safety signals. We might even see them sooner and be able to see trends sooner than a whole bunch of people grabbing forms and putting them together and hoping someone gets to them and looks and says, oh, there's, you know, interstitial lung disease, where we could have picked that up, you know, earlier. I also think we're going to get to a point in oncology and in clinical research where we're going to start seeing the pre-signals. And we can't do that unless we have this technology, but we're saying, okay, we know this person. If they have X, Y, and Z, they're going to have hospitalization in 15 days. That's where we're going. And this is the very first step.
People ask, what is a real-time clinical trial? It's where we, as FDA scientists, can see these endpoints or safety signals in the cloud as the trial is happening in real time, live. And so this is a new data feed that has the potential of making more efficient the massive data consolidation, analysis that goes into these giant applications, and just make it more efficient. It's really a milestone. If you think about pandemic preparedness, this is a huge...
This would have been a game changer.
Don't you think?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we in our roles, we were responsible for creating strategy around clinical research during COVID. And it was a nightmare. We didn't have data systems. Yeah, I remember it. At 7 a.m., we had an early a.m. call. At 5 p.m., we had a p.m. call. We looked at all of the clinical data from all of the emergency rooms across the healthcare system, the ICUs, and we had spreadsheets. I mean, it was primitive. So even at that level, not even thinking about trying to collect data in a trial, not leveraging systems to look for signals. And I agree with you. I think we'll get early signals. So I think it's transformative. The other place where I think that is can be a real game changer is, while we need process innovation in how we do the trials, we also need process innovation in what is necessary to get a product to approval. And what we were talking about a little bit earlier today is that as you go through this process, I am pretty certain you're going to realize you ask for too much data, and that actually how the trials will be done will require less invasive testing on the patients, which will actually increase their ability to participate remotely, which will completely democratize the ability of rural and urban environments to be able to participate. We require, for these RECIST criteria and oncology trials, MRIs done every 6 months, CAT scans done every alternative every 6 months.
Yeah.
So that's bringing your patients into the healthcare system. They don't need to be there.
Yeah.
So I really think that the utility of the information that you collect using this technology will not only help us execute our trials and industry design the trials, but also might help regulators reimagine what data points they need.
That's a great point. I mean, that was one of the focuses, like the way in which this real-time cloud trial worked was that when we started it, we said, hey, listen, send us over your protocol, right? And then what are we going to send back? We're going to send back what the reporting criteria, right? When you do that at that early phase in the process, what you're forcing the FDA, we're forcing the FDA to do is to make a decision on what's important.
Yeah.
You know, which actually gets to this point of like, what do you really need to make a decision? And so when you have to make those judgment calls, right, you know, it does. It changes the calculus of what do I actually really need to know in this part of the process. What's the onus we're putting on, mm-hmm. you know? And so that's one of the objectives of sort of the approach is to have the FDA work in concert with the sponsors to be like, let's think about what's necessary.
Minimum
necessary in order to get to a decision. That's because when you think about it, if you're kind of restart the process, that's where you start.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're like, okay, what's the bare minimum I need? Nothing more, right? And then over time, we'll build up certain, I needed that piece. I really would have liked, you know, the narrative, a little bit of the narrative information around this event or something mm-hmm. like that helps me, you know, quantify it. Okay, great. You know, or I wanted to have something additional around an adverse event type or whatever it might be. Those are literally the conversations I had yesterday, right? When as the team's seeing the data roll through, they're going, well, that's great. You know, I need a couple extra fields here and here, and that should be all I really need for this section, right? And the same thing then they're saying is, what data can we use inside the FDA that we already have, right, to help inform us around what's going on? So I think this gets to an aspect where, you know, the FDA traditionally has never really used all of its historical information and all of its previous data to help.
Very aware of that.
So this is a part of the process where, like, if you know, give me the least amount of information I need up front to make a decision, but let me be empowered to use all the information that we sit on that we have
mm-hmm.
in order to help drive to help understand what's actually happening here.
Yeah, it'll be sorry. Go
no,
ahead.
No. I was going to say, but do you see that then? Where the whole traditional, if you do a study, you wait for it to report out, then you write the phase two, then you wait for it to report out, then you could see where it's a single study with stop, mm-hmm. go, no, go, and we get quick answers from both, you know, the sponsor in academia mm-hmm. and the FDA, and it just triggers it without recontracting, without redoing it, and you write the one trial for the whole development with just the blanks of the couple places. So, yeah. I mean... the dead spaces that you were talking about, Commissioner, are long between trials.
Yes.
And we should be ready to roll with the next if we have that early signal that this one's going to change lives.
The RECOVER trial was actually a great example of that.
Is that the steroid trial?
Yeah, during COVID. So it had multiple arms. And so the way it was designed, it was sort of like an adaptive trial design where you come into this study and the first 40 patients would be randomized to A, B. And then you would do an interim analysis. And then based on the safety signal, you'd say, no, we're going to stop here, or lack of efficacy signal. Mm-hmm. But the people who had a response would continue. Then you add another arm.
Yep.
And then you keep on adding arms. Now, while that was a very good design during a pandemic where you didn't have companies sort of competing with, well, you had less of the companies competing with each other. It still is a model approach to rapid acquisition of data that drives decisions, real-time decisions. Would I love to see us stop having phase one, phase 1A, phase 1B, phase 2A, phase 2B, phase 3, another phase 3, phase 4? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because not only do I think it takes way too long, you don't get a lot of incremental information over that time.
Yes.
And you're describing the sort of gaps between.
Yes.
So obviously you're not saying we should not be doing clinical trials. What you're saying is the gaps between our dead time where we're doing paperwork, we're
correct.
Doing stuff that we, so we saw a statistic that I just mentioned, 45% of the time from the initiation of the phase one until the FDA final NDA or BLA application is dead time. That is, there's no ongoing clinical trial that's happening. So it makes what you're describing makes all the sense in the world. It makes so much sense that sometimes you wonder if
why
we can do it.
Why were we not doing it before?
When I think it begs both, right? Why weren't you doing it before?
Right.
Why weren't we? It's really a collective responsibility. Yeah. And if it's so intuitive that it should have been done, are we missing something along the way? Mm-hmm. And I think you won't know that. The proof's going to be in the pudding of how you actually do it. And I also think that we don't actually know what the right answer is. You know, this is going to be very much a learning process. You know, I don't even call it a pilot approach. I think this is an iterative process that as we go along, we won't necessarily stop to say, was that right or was that wrong? We'll actually just keep on reinventing as we go through the process.
You know, the irony is some U.S. centers refuse to participate in the recovery trial because it didn't meet their elaborate study design preconceived ideas. But in the end, maybe the intervention that saved the most lives in 2020 mm-hmm. was the use of steroids mm-hmm. in the ICU early. Mm-hmm. So notice I said 2020 to avoid the...
I know. I was going to challenge your company. Right. Not a good idea to challenge the commissioner, but that's what we leave it there.
So are we going to add something, Jennifer?
Oh.
I didn't know if I cut you
off. No, that's okay.
So in 1747, mm-hmm. James Lind did what may have been the first clinical trial for scurvy.
Yep.
And so do you want to tell the story?
Maybe I do. You know. I love this story.
Didn't know I was going to say it, so that's fantastic that she knows it.
I might even actually challenge the date. I think that was the date that it was published.
I think you're right.
But the study was actually done earlier. This is such a neat study. So it was conducted amongst the British Navy. And they sent out, they knew that seamen were dying, but had no idea why. So this particular physician decided he would design the first ever clinical trial. He didn't know it was a clinical trial. And he randomized 12 sailors to 6 different interventions. Oh, I'm not going to remember
peels,
all of them.
Vinegar,
salt water. There was something.
Salt water. I remember that. Yeah, I mean, tastes disgusting.
And and then one was citrus fruits. Mm-hmm. And they demonstrated that citrus fruits dramatically prevented the onset of scurvy, mm-hmm. Which was why the British Navy then became known as Limeys.
Well, the Navy refused for many years to adopt the findings.
Yes, they did.
You know, they did what you see happens today in modern medicine, and that is you have a very... powerful trial, mm-hmm. and people find a way to nitpick it mm-hmm. and ignore the results and write it off because they may not have liked the person who did the trial. Mm-hmm. But it was a classic example of how the dogma that it couldn't possibly be
true.
Right?
Yeah.
And if you think about history, there were over 1 million people that died of scurvy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was... And tragically, it affected the African slaves.
Yes, it did.
They came across. They would lose half the crew, half the individuals and passengers. And ironically, the cure was right in front of their eyes, but ignored mm-hmm. for a long time. So there was that publication in 1747. Mm-hmm. Famous trial showing the polio vaccine mm-hmm. Helped eradicate polio. And then today at the FDA, the first real-time clinical trial, thanks to all of you. So it's a historic day in clinical trial
Happy
history.
Happy to be part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
What did you think when you learned about this opportunity?
You know, I think that one of the worst things as an oncologist is when you know you have a drug that's showing promise, you've given it to patients in their, you know, phase one, and you have patients who have no other options, and you know this drug, but it's in the dead time. Mm. And it really matters. Mm-hmm. And these patients are holding on. They're waiting for us to write the trials. They're waiting for us to activate the trials. So every day that we hold on activating a trial or have it on hold to patient, it matters to real people.
Yeah. You think about some of these new drugs that are getting approved. Every day matters, you know. You've seen that both in the.
Yeah.
What's your clinical area, by the way?
Cardiology.
What's that? Heart stuff.
Kinda.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you're good.
This side.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Yours probably sits in the middle.
That's my kind of cardiologist, right there. But you know, you think about people who are, when you break bad news, mm-hmm. and you see people clamoring for any kind of hope. And sadly, I think we've all done this way too many times. And there's no textbook that prepares you for it. Mm-hmm. And it's always hard. It never gets easier. And you think about people who are just asking the question, is there anything humanly possible on earth that can be done to live longer? And you start asking these questions, mm-hmm. right, as somebody proximate to that. And you realize delays in the system have risks. Mm-hmm. They have risks.
Yeah.
The risk is it may prevent somebody or delay somebody from getting a promising therapy.
Yeah, I think that's really real. I'll give you two concrete examples. First is baby KJ, right? Gene editing. I work very closely with that team on getting that submission to the FDA, and had the opportunity to meet the family. And they were holding on to threads. Now, that wasn't a clinical trial. It was a single patient treatment use. But that desperation, you see all the time. The second is that the way we write clinical trials is overly cautious. And I think this is in part because what are the reporting criteria? And so more often than not, we have patients who don't meet the eligibility criteria for trials, but we can't write the next trial until the data from the first trial is in there.
Yeah.
And that is exceptionally common, that you have patients in clinic and you really can't do anything for them because we're just too inefficient in what we're doing. And it's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah. I think this is one of the, you know, I was having a conversation. Someone asked me, like, how summarize, right, what you're trying to accomplish here. And I said, it's very simple. It's like aggressive vision, and we're going to iterate the implementation,
mm-hmm.
right? We're going to do fast turns on this. We've already actually done this, you know, with the data, with the initial, we sent over our clinical trial reporting scheme. That went out over to the sponsor, passed to the vendor. They were looking at it. They came back with some additional things that they wanted to add into it, came back to us, made the updates back to them. We've done that like three times
mm-hmm.
in just a couple of weeks. And so this idea of you know, and then they're saying, hey, we think we want a new way of analyzing this specific criteria. And then the sponsor's saying, hey, maybe we can do this. And the FDA team is like, well, maybe we can do this.
Yeah.
So this is the pace and the sort of, it gets everybody in the boat.
Yeah.
You know, not to make a pun on our previous conversation, but it gets everybody in the boat, right? Yeah. You know, that you're all working for the same objective, is to get to an answer as quickly as possible,
mm-hmm.
you know, and as safe and effective as possible, you know, and that's what we're seeing is yeah. we're seeing all the different parties coming together, because it can't be like, I think to accelerate this, to move it at the pace that we needed to move it for patients, we can't all just sit back and just say, well, it's not my, I'll wait for the other person to come in and do their part. I'll wait for the other person to come in and do their part. Or we had to mail it over.
Mm.
And we're waiting on a response, right? Like that's a horrible thing to say to patients, right? And so I think everyone has sort of a, if you're in this space, you have a moral obligation to sort of come in and everyone work together to try to get there as fast as possible.
It has to happen that way. Yeah. We call it poking the balloon.
Yeah.
That if you don't look back and you're just, I'm going to fix this one spot at a time, you've stuck your finger in the balloon, but nothing changed,
yeah.
right? Mm. And that happens all too often. And this is why the FDA, academia, our sponsors, taking that 40,000 foot view, it's the only way it's going to work.
It is. Mm. It is. And that's what I've seen definitely in this process, was that everybody coming together, you know, is what's really sort of driving.
Mm.
And different people are coming up with different ideas. And I think the goal now is, there's two parts I'd love to sort of see, right? From industry, from academia, from all these sponsors, to say, okay, the FDA said we can move, right?
Mm.
It's carte blanche, let's go. Right? Like, and not just, you talk about process improvement, not just on just the trial part, right? We touched on other areas of
yeah.
the process as
yep.
well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where else can you work with sponsors and your different engagement mechanisms to say, this is taking too long?
How much time do you have? Lots of ideas on that one. And not only sponsors,
yes.
but you mentioned earlier the IND submission process.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
There's, you know, I would make a point here that I think you will always find academia to be a willing partner, in mm. part because there's very much a mutual benefit.
Mm-hmm.
We are on the front line treating the patients. And so there's this kind of added incentive for us to do right by the patient. And that's not to say that pharma isn't also motivated by good, but if you're not actually in the trenches. So one thing that will drive the ultimate success of this innovation is that pharma really buys into it, right? So when we submit INDs to the FDA, pharma either submits them, it's a classic industry-funded, industry-sponsored trial,
mm-hmm.
which is big business, really complicated, really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have these really innovative discoveries that are done under research INDs.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
they still result in products. Penn has 55 of them.
Yep.
And when we go through that process, our ability to partner with the FDA, life-changing.
Yes.
CAR T-cell, we couldn't have done that if the FDA wasn't a partner. CRISPR, we couldn't have done it if the FDA wasn't a partner. So really making sure that industry holds up its bit, academia holds up it. It really has to be a sustained partnership to make it work.
Yeah.
What's interesting about the IND process, because we have been deep in the IND phase one world for the last year, and hopefully we'll have pretty soon some pretty powerful announcements to make about reforming that process, because we're losing our competitive edge internationally, and we've got to modernize and streamline that process to focus on safety. And we can focus on safety and reduce a lot of the onerous requirements or defer them. Mm-hmm. And so we have a massive endeavor. One thing that we've learned is that sponsors will submit a lot of information that we don't need for the IND. Mm-hmm. That is the stuff that they perceive we want, but we don't want it, or at least we don't want it at that point. We can look at it later, or we don't need it, along the lines of the 66 million page application that you had received. But there's this arms race where they perceive, hey, let's just send everything, every printout of every side test and study. And sometimes we don't set clear guidance on what we require and don't require, or we say what we do require, and then it's a gray area, and they're sort of doing guesswork. Do we want this additional information? So we have talked about making it very clear on the FDA website what you do not need to submit for different stages.
Okay.
For an IND, you do not need to submit X, Y, and Z. And so maybe that explicit clarity.
It will help. It will absolutely help. If you look at the difference between an IND submitted by an academic institution versus an IND submitted by industry, they're night and day.
They're night and day.
They go through the same review process.
And it's like half of the INDs are academic, I would say. Something
yes.
like
yeah. Yes. Yeah, that. Yes. Yes. Yeah. They are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if the FDA is willing to approve it based on that volume of data, there's definitely room for improvement there. And look forward to that. That's wonderful.
We've got to do it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think it gets to the point when you mentioned, like, as opposed to poking a part of the balloon, is, you know, there's been a big focus here around the whole thing, right? You know, when you think about it from the pre-IND to IND to now what we announced today with the real-time trials to the filing review, right, which we'll get down to a day until it's almost there. Instead of
2 months,
right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, it made sense when you had to bring in all the paper. Yeah. Lay it all out.
Yeah.
Crates of paper. Right? Before check, have someone walk around with a checklist, make sure you got everything before you actually say you're good to go on the review. Mm-hmm. And then you actually look at that, and then you think about the review, which is now done in, you know, that demonstrated through the commissioner's, you know, priority voucher program, down to 44 days, 40, 50 days, less than 60 days. So you look at that, right? And it was, I think the point is, you couldn't just focus on one thing, right? You had to look at the whole thing. Right. And it gets down to the process improvement side. It's like what's been done. And so we've been doing this, I think, and we've been hitting each part of the process, each part of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like that. It's like, I don't know if laying siege to it is the right term, but it's been like something where you're working on each part at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think what people are starting to realize is that was done with purpose, with focus, with energy to actually get to these outcomes, which we're at today, right?
Jeremy, what's next for real-time clinical trials?
Sure, I think, you know, what's next is we're gonna go from what we built was a proof of concept, and we demonstrated that this is entirely possible working live. So now we wanna scale that, right? So that goes from a proof of concept into sort of what we'll call a pilot program. You know, we had the RFI announced today, so we're looking forward to sort of industry's feedback around you know, everything that's going to be involved and what they want us, and, you know, just in general what their thoughts are, right?
Yeah.
You know, so we look forward to receiving all those responses. Then from there, we'll launch sort of the pilot program. Not going to sort of say this is the final selection. I think we're teetering between, you know, 10 and 15 sort of trials that we're looking for, but that'll come out in the final sort of pilot announcement. And the goal there is to look, and we're focused, I think, our initial thinking is to focus on those early phases, those phase ones, those early phase twos.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do to sort of get that information over in real time, get up to our reviewers so that they can make a regulatory decision, mm-hmm. that they can help say we can move this forward or you know, this has got some concerns and we need to have a deeper look at that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where we go next, is we go into the and then from there, it's you take the successes of that, and to your point, Emma, iterate it. Just keep iterating it until we get it refined and good, and then it becomes an operational capability.
So one suggestion.
Yeah.
Include one or two academic INDs in your group of nine.
It's already been suggested.
Surprise, surprise.
Yes.
And we have a menu for you. 250 of them.
I think we are excited about about this. You know, I the biggest thing of my concern is, can we scale it? Can we move as fast as we want to move? Right.
Yeah.
I think that the desire to move faster is now. Yeah, now that we've shown it's possible, right? Mm-hmm. I think the question is how do we institutionalize that, and how do we make it part of the process?
Yeah.
And so
willing industry partnership is essential.
Yeah.
You get one or two on board; they're quite competitive amongst each other. The onus will to bring the others.
I have no idea what you're talking about. We've never heard of it.
No.
So if you're out there in the world listening right now, you're probably saying, what a beautiful campus, and I would love to come work at the FDA, and the good news is we are hiring thousands of scientists, so good observation. Number two, you're probably saying, I can't wait to get to the RFI and read it and provide public comment. Thank you very much. And number three, you might be saying, how do I participate in a real-time clinical trial? And that's coming. That'll be in the formal pilot after we get through this proof of concept phase this summer. Is that the plan this summer's?
I think end of spring, early summer would be kind of our goal.
After the public comment period.
Yep.
Yeah. So we want input along the entire process. We want it from everybody.
Yep.
And so so that's good. So it seems like this is a first step.
Mm-hmm.
This towards continuous trials, towards bigger things, towards reducing what we call the white space, that is the time between clinical trials where 45% of the time in a drug development is now white space. But this is not the silver bullet, the real-time trial. This is a step towards bigger thinking, but hopefully it is letting people know and it's sending a signal that we are willing to be as creative as we can be while ensuring public safety.
Yep.
So that's why your perspectives are so valuable in this process. Yeah,
I love the concept of partnership. I mean, it feels different, you know, feels like we can do, and it's not just this piece, right? It's applying data science tools to real world evidence, synthetic data, how we collect data in trial from wearables. Yeah, there's lots of reform that can happen throughout the entire process. So it's exciting because you kind of feel if you have a win in one corner, you get to move down the pike.
And it's accepting trials. You know, we can't do the trials of 1995 anymore, over and over and over again. And we have, you know, for the first time in my career, really, I have patients where the new drugs are outpacing their metastatic disease.
Wow.
You know, when I think of these patients with HER2 positive or hormone receptor positive, and now even triple negative breast cancer, you know, it's happening so fast. And it's happening so fast that even when you do a phase 3 randomized clinical trial, the comparator arm is out of date by the time you even start putting those patients on the trial.
Mm.
So we're now thinking, how are we going to rethink how we do trials? I have now 3 drugs that dropped in the exact same spot, and I don't know what's the best for my patient.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to rethink how we do trials, how we get quick, you know, kill bad drugs quickly and move on to the next one. And I think just like the trial you were talking about, we have to start thinking outside of the box and get answers faster.
Yeah, I agree.
Did you have experience with people enrolling in the real-time clinical trial to be able to say that this got them energized, they were all excited, they were interested, or was this something that was at a clinical level where you weren't directly part of the consent and didn't have that feedback?
So the trial we did at MD Anderson was in a different disease site.
Right.
So I did not personally do it. It was in lymphoma. But Michael Wong has led it, and he's been doing an amazing job.
Okay.
I can tell you from the experience for the AstraZeneca mantle cell lymphoma trial, there's a learning curve. It's not naturally intuitive. And so taking the time to train the people in the trenches as to how you actually make the connection. The technologies are both excellent, but you've got to create the APIs between clinical pipe and the EHR, and then you've got to train the staff on. So that there's bits in there that there will be a learning curve.
Change management.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. The one thing I will say is, in our conversations with the team, the PI was totally on, the physician, totally on board. Anything that could keep their CRC in their role for a month longer. The CRCs and the project managers and the regulatory people are, anything that changes how we currently do it, we're willing to try.
Okay, great. Great.
So I really, when I say the proof is in the pudding, we just need a little bit more experience, and there will be bugs in the process in trying to get it executed. But the willingness and the enthusiasm to do things differently is there. The timing couldn't be better. Yeah.
The why is strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that the great thing is that the technology components are all there now. Right. I don't know if they were there, they weren't all there 10 years ago.
Oh, they were not there.
They weren't there 10 years. There were pieces, right?
Yeah.
But now there is no technical limitation. There's no reason that this cannot be done, that we cannot scale the analysis of data, at site, with the criteria that the FDA says we need to hear about. Right. There's no way that there's no reason this can't be done. And so so I think from this one, the real time clinical trial is as much a process change. Right.
Mm.
But it's we're saying we're going to move at it. We want to move at an exceptional speed here. We're going to leverage the latest technologies to do it. There's no technical limitation. So let's clean up the process and let's fix that.
And there's an access issue, whereby you can actually expand access to clinical trials in this program, as you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah,
explain the rationale.
Well,
there.
I think there's number one, there's the speed issue. So being able to get more people on if you can run more of a continuous trial, right? So there's access there.
Mm-hmm.
There's the amazing work that's done at the medical centers that you both are part of. But there's also expanding things out into the community and rural settings too.
Yeah,
where there's a need. I think the numbers are 70% of most people live within about 2 hours of a medical center, right? So that you can cover a large portion, but 30% that's 30% that isn't covered by that, right? So looking at technical solutions that you can still onboard people into within rural settings, where they don't have that immediate access, getting industry to be able to sort of collect the real time data that's happening in those more rural environments. That opens up a huge portion of people.
I don't think it's just related to this technology.
Yeah.
The one thing that COVID showed us when we had to shut down everything, we continued to do research remotely.
Yep.
And the regulations were all modified to allow that to happen. Now they've kind of crept back in there a little bit, but I know they will be changed back. But the ability to leverage telehealth for research purposes is enormous. And we should be doing that all over the place. The ability to ship medication across state lines, that should be easy.
Yes.
Currently isn't. Our ability to take blood pressure recordings off, your Ring or your Apple Watch, and to incorporate that data into the EHR, that's technologically possible.
Yes.
We just don't incorporate it. So there's so many technology solutions that we need a concentrated commitment on the part of the regulator accepting that data, the pharmaceutical company agreeing to that change, because that's a big culture, and then academia making it happen.
Yeah.
We implement what pharma wants us to do.
I think that blood pressure one, it's an interesting one. If you've got someone in a remote setting and you can stream their blood pressure information back to you, right? Under the real-time clinical trial approach, as long as you're analyzing that data, you can send a signal on me if you're seeing blood pressure, if that's part of the reporting criteria for that specific, trial, you could send that signal to me, but I don't necessarily need to see the data, right? So the idea that you have to collect and process and manage all that data is not necessarily a requirement of what we're thinking about from the real-time clinical trial aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an aspect too of normally you'd have to get all that data, so get all that real-world evidence data, and then eventually trying to stream that or submit that to the FDA, where we would then receive that.
Yeah.
It's not
makes sense.
It's the goal is to sort of say, is to say if we trust that you're analyzing the data correctly, right? You can get a stream as much information. You just tell us what you're using as that, and you can send us the signal. You know, but it kind of changes the focus, and it like puts the innovation piece back into your lane, right? And back into your side to say, I can collect and grab as much information as I want as part of this trial. And if I don't have to end up collecting all that and providing it to the FDA, you know, what does that mean to how quickly I can?
It reduces the mindless collection of data for an unknown purpose.
Yeah.
And your 6,000 or 660,000 pages.
66 million.
There you
million.
Go. There
66
you
go. Million.
I just can't imagine even reading.
I mean, most are like
no one did.
Thousand.
Crazy.
And that's
crazy.
Time of a patient too. You know, there's, you know, why do we need this many EKGs in this time?
That's a huge.
I've never seen anyone make a major change based on these, you know, 8 time points within the same day, and the patient's running up and down, and I think that, you know, your guidance on decentralized trials have been really helpful as we really think through hard IRB questions of who really needs to be on the 1572. No, you can see your regular doctor near your home who does a history and physical as part of their routine scope of care. And we can ask these questions and have not make people come out of work.
Yep.
You know, 3 times a week when they don't need to. And I think even that, and if we, the proof will be in the pudding again, is that getting drugs to the endpoint by using those trial structures, I think once we get our first one there, it will be a floodgate. Mm. And it'll be the best thing for patients.
Sweet. There they go, making sense again. Way too logical. Okay, final question. How is the food at your hospitals? Are you serving ultra-processed food or real food?
No, real food.
Good.
Yeah, interestingly enough, so you know, Penn is one of those campuses that just keeps on building, right? They have buildings. So as long as you go to the newest building, you get the healthy choices. If you go to the old building, bangers and mash, here we are. But the newer buildings, yeah, it's good. And I think it's a strategic investment in healthy living, that the food is... I'm going to say, by reputation, is really good. I've never eaten at work, so I can't really tell you.
Are you NPO all day or what?
Pretty much, yeah, yeah.
About an MD Anderson?
I'm not NPO all day. you know, I think that there's been a very active move to move into, you know, healthier eating. They've changed many of our cafeteria choices. We now have healthy options in vending machines that are in every building. So at any point of the day, you can go and get a healthy salad and not have to go and sandwiches.
Okay. Not just ding dongs without
our not ding dongs. It's hard. Yes.
Well, that's important. It's a big initiative in this.
No, it is a big it is a big initiative, and I would say it's actually a big area of scientific study at Penn is the whole thing around healthy food choices and advertising and how we actually play an incredibly important role in how we portray the foods that we eat. And so, yeah, no, it's
yeah, we've seen the work of Kevin Volpe.
Yeah.
Yep. And so we're eager to see some of that trial data readout.
Yeah, there's more coming out. It's a really neat study, which is a perfect example of what you're trying to use. So he uses this platform called Way to Health that they built at Penn, and that they use it to collect food inventories of patients living throughout the urban areas, which cover very large sociodemographic groups, and cardiovascular outcomes, obesity outcomes, and diabetes outcomes.
A real-time food trial.
Real-time food trial. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. But prospective. I'm not sure I'd call it a trial because there's no intervention.
Single arm,
observational, prospective, real-time. Yeah.
But it's real because we are seeing, you know, we're definitely seeing younger onsets of cancer, and we think that's related to a lot of these issues and the processed foods. But we are really spending an earthquake in June 7th. We're spending a lot of time digging into where we shouldn't because we're deep into the microbiome.
Yeah, good.
And that is, you know, we are just finding out so much there and how it affects your immune system and fighting cancer, how different drugs work differently based on what's in your GI system, and it all comes back to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you are what you eat.
Something you wrote a lot about.
I thought we were wrapping it up. As good stuff. I mean, it is. Microbiome is, in my opinion, the great frontier organ system in the body that we know the least about, that we should know more about. And when you look at increasing rates of GI malignancies in people under age 50, and that plus liver cancer, which, you know, you could argue liver is part of the GI tract, those are the cancers increasing as the other cancers are decreasing, generally speaking. How could it not have something to do with the interface of what's directly proximate to the GI tract? And when you look at some of these intriguing studies that are observational and, you know, you cannot derive sweeping conclusions, but in JAMA Surgery, a study looking at the association between colon cancer in young people and C-section delivery. What do we know about C-section delivery? You have a different microbiome by C-section delivery. Now, C-sections save lives, and sometimes you need to have a C-section. But these are sort of big questions where now the door is opening and we're starting to realize there's a lot there that we don't know that we should know. Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah.
More work for the scientists.
More work for your researchers and more grants. So,
yeah.
Thank you for being here.
Pleasure.
Historic day at the FDA, and it's an honor to share it with both of you. So,
as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Good to be with you. We'll do it again. Thanks.